Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
The Mr. Beacon podcast is sponsored by Wiliot, scaling IoT with battery-free Bluetooth.
Welcome to the Mr. Beacon podcast. Really pleased to have you join us and joining Dana Lowell, who is a friend and a colleague who I've worked with, co-founder of Seamless IoT. Dana, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, great, Steve. It's fantastic to be here. Glad to be speaking with you again, and thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
Well, we were talking about what we would, the theme of this podcast, and you have years of experience in the automotive business through from General Motors through to Forcia, and you've been instrumental in setting up an organization, Seamless, that helps bring entrepreneurs and the Babel fish, to use Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy reference, that translates between large corporations, and they don't get much bigger than car companies, and these small entrepreneurs. So you've been dealing with that ability to bring those together. So I thought we could call this episode How to Make Friends and Influence People in the World of IoT and Automotive. And I'd love to talk to you about your experiences in doing that, any observations you have about IoT and automotive, and any other fun stuff that we get to on cars and where that technology is going. So first of all, let's get into this challenge of, you know, what are the challenges of that face large corporations that want to innovate on one hand, and small startup entrepreneurial companies that see these big companies as organizations they want to get into and partner with. Is that easy? Is it hard? What are the challenges?
Yeah, I mean, this is Steve. You and I have talked a lot about this over our time together. I mean, the DNA of a large multinational corporation or enterprise is very different than a startup. And this analogy may get off track, but I mean, I kind of look at it like hippopotamuses and hummingbirds. And you know, the hippopotamus is large. It lives a long time. It minimizes movement or change to save energy. And it's, you know, it's more about incremental change and process improvement. While a startup is about, you know, speed, it's about burning lots of energy, short learning loops, and, you know, moving fast, and an ability to pivot quickly, depending on where it gets signals on, positive signals of where it needs to go. And those are very different, you know, DNAs to match up. And it's, you know, it's a challenge, I think, for every corporation to figure out, how do I get innovation from startups and how do I successfully partner with startups? When you're in a corporate setting, you know, if you're in a big corporate, I'm talking about budgets, and I'm talking about approval processes, and I'm talking about process adherence. You know, and the mindset in a Startup is about, you know, is it's fundraising, it's experiments successfully completed, it's where I'm getting market signals. So they're talking about different things. There's almost a different language between those two organizations. You know, my career on the corporate side, it's really about optimization of process, optimization of footprint, risk reduction for the corporation. Well, you know, if you talk to the startup about that, they're talking about, you know, how do I get the proof of value and how do I scale? You know, the different kinds of objectives, and the objectives cascade into, you know, how you get compensated with your bonuses and ultimately your budgets. So there's different behaviors that are encouraged inside both organizations.
So this is, I think it's a great metaphor. You've got this kind of the clock cycle, the metabolism of the hummingbird. You've got this hippopotamus that has strong, huge, very visible, moving, but moving slowly and really has struggles to move fast. So we'll get into what goes wrong when the hummingbird and the hippo come into proximity. But let's just kind of drill into, you know, why. And I guess for the... It's made it probably obvious for the startup. You're this brand, you're creating this brand, you're this new thing, and you try to want to scale, I guess, quickly. You see the opportunity to sell lots of your stuff either with or to the this Goliath. Why is it worth... Why do corporates even care about these startups? Is it... Are they a luxury? How important is it for corporates to work with startups?
I think it's critically important because I think really the innovation that comes to a corporate from the startup is really irreplaceable. I mean, I think in a corporate setting, you're looking at a budget that's, you know, 90% today focused and 10% tomorrow focused. While in a startup, you're looking at a budget that's 10% today focused and 90% tomorrow focused. And bringing those two things together, you know, a company that has scale and ability and resources and, you know, purchasing ability and all the different infrastructure things that can be brought to bear from a corporate standpoint in terms of access to market, access to technology, bringing in a startup that has the ability to really focus on some of the growth vectors and the market signals that the corporate is not going to be able to, you know, respond to today because it's focused on today. But the startup can focus on those weak market signals that really are going to be tomorrow for the large corporate enterprise. And so marrying those two things together, I think, is of critical importance. I think that's the opportunity that exists for the startup to find the right strategic partners and for the corporate to have the fuel to get them to what tomorrow is going to be.
I totally agree. And we've all seen, those of us who've been around a while, have seen companies that seemed indomitable. They were indestructible. They were so successful. They had books written about their success. And then suddenly they collapsed because they just couldn't adapt. Technology's driving change. And you know, the Kodaks, and a lot of the car companies, you see what the challenges they go through, and they've got to essentially eat their own babies. They've got to kill off these businesses, but the timing is critical. And so, you know, we've even seen big companies that say, look, we're just going to kill you, and they're going to spin off businesses that they think will just not be able to flourish because they've hired people and they've got the processes and the DNA is just incapable of pivoting and adapting in the way that is necessary for startups. So I think we're both convinced that they have to work together. Why is this not easy? Why did your employer need you to do what you do to bridge the gap between the small guys and the big guys?
Well, I mean, I think why it's not easy is, I mean, it's the cultural thing that you and I were already talking about. And then there's also that the existing processes and practice in a multinational corporation are based upon, you know, very high scale, you know, talking hundreds of thousands or millions of units. And the processes are designed to engage with companies that are able to be at that scale. And so if you take a startup and you ask them to engage with something that's used to dealing with something that's in hundreds or thousands or millions of units at scale, and a startup is still in the process of defining technology, team, business model, those are just grossly out of sync with one another. So you need some type of a buffer mechanism to take up that slack. And that's been the rise of a lot of these third-party organizations, such as, you know, accelerator programs, incubator programs, whether they're independent or they're, inside the organization, built into the organization. And that's, there's been a lot of these third party kind of programs to help take the slack out or create the bandwidth to bring on a startup into an existing organization. The other problem is inside, you know, existing corporate is that, you know, the payback in the bonus structure is usually not as tied to, you know, today's revenue and profitability, not what it's going to be 5 years from now if this startup is successful and this technology is adopted. So there's not, the reward structures are typically not in place within the business groups inside a corporate to really foster, and they need fostering, foster a startup success.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's critically success. It's critical to the success of entrepreneurs in big companies and in startups to understand this, to survive. And, you know, one of the manifestations of this problem I saw at Williot is we were excited. We're closing a deal with a really big company, and it came time to negotiate the contract. And we were given a 100-page contract that we had to negotiate. And we're like, this, if we do this, this will blow our entire legal budget for the entire year. We just can't afford to even get advice on what you're sending us. And they're like, oh, yeah, let me give us a few days. And then we finally realized, oh, yeah, we were dealing with you in the kind of peer-to-peer manner, and we can probably dispense with most of this. So that kind of worked out. But I feel like, you know, there's a lot of collateral damage that can get done by stuff like that, where you end up, and let's say this startup and this big company end up, you know, they end up trying to make that work, and the big company can push a whole bunch of costs and slow down the small company. And so all the advantages of dealing with the small company end up being nullified. You end up, you know, getting the worst of both worlds, which is just a nightmare. So how does Seamless come about, and how does something like Seamless help solve this problem?
Well, I mean, Seamless is one of those third-party mechanisms. It was created as a regional ecosystem, innovation ecosystem, that we were able to take some leading manufacturing companies located in Michigan. So you had, you know, Steelcase, and you had Automotive in Forcia, you had Whirlpool, Amway, a couple of healthcare providers in the system that were locally headquartered in the Michigan area. We brought them together. They were non-competing. The idea was, one, to get rid of all the middleware, to get rid of stuff like, you know, you talk to one of the large corporates about getting an NDA. You know, that can be a couple of month long process to get an NDA for a startup. A startup doesn't have time to wait for that. Get them into the supply system, you know, so that they can be paid. That's might be a couple of month process. So, you know, for a startup that's looking at what their opportunity costs are every day, it may not be, you know, maybe in a cash burn mode, you know, for them to wait 3 months before serious conversations can occur is not acceptable. So we took all that middleware, kind of put it in Seamless, so we could do, you know, 24-hour turns on NDAs and get them into a payable system quickly. And then the other thing was to be able to provide different industrial sectors. So we could have, you know, for example, say Steelcase Whirlpool, Versia as an example. You have three different sectors: office furniture, white goods, home appliances, and automotive. And so for a startup, you know, you're engaging with three sectors simultaneously, and you're getting to look under the hood of those three sectors in terms of determining what's my fastest route to market, where can I scale most quickly, which one of these market opportunities is giving me the strongest market signals. And then from the corporate standpoint, we're able to blend our resources and obviously costs to do that proof of value with the startup. So it's really kind of a lean innovation startup corporate engagement model.
Yeah, I think I'm just thinking about what is, given that we have entrepreneurs in big companies in our audience, we have entrepreneurs in small companies. And I think you have a lot of experience helping big companies get that system in place, which I think is valuable. So the call to action for big companies is pretty simple. It's like they can call you and you can help them. But what does a small company need to do, knowing that there's this compatibility problem? I guess, is it just use the fact that these organizations exist and look for the innovation team, know that you're going to have a better conversation if you find someone who's actually prepared to talk your language and be responsive. Is that the advice for a startup?
I think for a startup, I think, because we do invest, or we have done investing. I think that the thing when I talk to the startups is, where can you scale fastest so that you can get your markets established, get your market signals? And what's the chance of commercialization with that market? You know, so if you're looking at multiple sectors, what's the speed I can get through that sector to be commercial, and what kind of probabilities do I attach to it? Do I have the right relationships? Is the product fit really good? Am I solving a problem that's very obvious? And that's the market that you need to prioritize. I've always appreciated the Williott EAP program because I thought it provided discipline on both sides, really, in terms of what you were looking for and also what you needed from the corporate partner. Most startups don't have that. Most startups are just really looking for, a signal, and they tend to wander about. What I really liked about your program is the EAP program provided, a format of how we were going to work together and some rigor and discipline about what were the lessons learned and objectives to be achieved for both parts.
Yeah, I think it has worked well for us. And I think it's something that just evolved out of necessity. We just realized that we were small and there were so many opportunities, and how do we deal with that? And what we found, we actually thought this was going to be a real turnoff to our potential customers asking for some money. Having this kind of process, it worked with our process. It's kind of basically, we're going to do some designing and we're going to do some prototyping, and then we're going to do some piloting, and this is what it costs. And we actually thought, this is going to be a struggle. But what we found was actually the innovation teams and organizations like Seamless were like, this makes sense. And it didn't slow things down at all. It actually was a really positive thing. So, and you guys, Seamless was one of the first to kind of that we worked with in that way. And so we actually have you to thank, Dana, for kind of encouraging us and mentoring us in, and to kind of stick with that process.
To me, frankly, as a corporate guy, when I see a startup that isn't asking for money, that tells me that they're not a very good startup. They won't be around, right? All they've done is just signed up for burning their own cash and without an outcome. That to me is problematic and a warning sign, really, in terms of the quality of the startup.
Yeah, it's becomes, and for us, it became just a qualifier. It's like, Are we going to end up as being one line on someone's status report, or is this going to get visibility? We're asking for some money here, and so that means that leadership need to get involved, and we want that exposure. We want them to kind of show that there's real interest, and they're going to be serious, and they're going to follow through, because the money's very, very valuable. But it's as much as anything, it's a validation you can take to your board to say, look, these people are serious. And it's also, you just get better results from the partnership because they've thought about it and someone had to do an ROI on making that investment. So, but I think it's, I mean, I remember I was in a startup years ago and innovation teams didn't exist. And it was a nightmare getting involved with these big companies. And I see now that things have changed, and it's really important for people to know where to go in the organization. But I think what you said is beyond that. It's some real thought about how your offering is going to, what difference it's going to make to the corporation and the ability to ramp, and many, many factors. So, I don't know. I feel like maybe now is the time for us to step to this other subject area. And, a lot of these engagements that you've been at the center of have been around IoT. I'm sure not all of them. What are you seeing in IoT and automotive? It's not always obvious to people what that intersection is. We think about IoT and home automation and, maybe in some industrial context, but what's the impact of IoT on automotive, and where do you see interesting stuff happening?
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If I think about the areas that are really interesting, I think, the connected customer supply demand chain management is really interesting, because if you think about a tier one or tier two or tier three automotive or any supplier, you're making your thing, then you're shipping it to somebody that puts it into another thing, then ultimately ships it into a consumable. And in my industry, that consumable, the vehicle, OEM's car, goes to a dealership. And then it goes to a customer, and it may go to another customer. We lose sight of that once it goes to the OEM for assembly. So the ability for us to now be able to understand who the end customer of our product is and be able to look at things like functionality and performance, in an ongoing manner, is a tremendous amount of insight that really, the power of that, I don't think the industry has fully grasped yet. I think the OEMs obviously understand it, but I think the tier one, two, three community is only beginning to get their heads around, well, what can I do in terms of managing and knowing the customer better in terms of how they're using my product? Because that's typically tied up ultimately, you're getting feedback from the OEM in terms of performance in things like warranty claims. Maybe it's JD Power surveys you're going to get that are like, it kind of giving you an abstract view of how your product may be performing, but nothing really direct. So I think that's an area that to me was really exciting. And again, it was something that we've talked a lot about. I think another area that's really interesting, and the one that's best exploiting it now, is probably Tesla, but over the air updates, and be able to both fix and patch the performance of your product over time, being able to update it over time. Because in my industry, you know, a car depreciates 30%, 40% when you drive it off the lot. What if you started thinking about the car appreciating over time because you're constantly being able to update functionalities in the vehicle? So that's really intriguing. You can think about things like, you know, obviously upgrading some functions, but you could think about a winter set of features, maybe a summer set of features that can be changed. Maybe there's special updates that are being given on when you're going to go on vacation or when you're going to go out on date night. I mean, so there's this big opportunity in terms of being able to push and pull information from the vehicle to kind of customize performance, improve it as it ages, rather than just letting it be a large depreciating asset.
This is super interesting, and I think it kind of changed the role of the automotive company, or maybe it doesn't. I don't know, but it certainly changes the way I look at it. They become even more of a platform player because I don't know. As if you're a component supplier and you want to enjoy the and offer the benefits of the over-the-air updates, are you basically at the mercy of the OEM? The you know, Tesla's probably not going to make it easy for someone that makes a component to do that over-the-air thing. You're kind of, do they have kind of the control of that gateway?
Yeah, I think that's something that's still going to be, that's still a little bit of a to-be-determined ground. I think ultimately it's going to depend on what's the value we can deliver through those updates. And those updates may obviously be managed through the OEM, but if we can deliver value in that update, maybe we now understand a comfort algorithm that provides better lumbar comfort or better heating regime for the vehicle or better safety setting in terms of helping with alertness. I mean, if we can determine those values and provide those values, then I think that ultimately that end consumer will benefit from them, and the OEM will allow us to push some of that through, whether it comes through their update or an update that we may provide.
Yeah. Yeah, if there's the value, then you probably get in line to have that, enjoy some of the benefits of that. Very good. Yeah, I mean, a lot of this can be generally seen as, so, okay, if I can connect everything to the internet, what does that mean? And the whole, I think the great thing about what you touched on there, the supply chain transparency, I think every business model is being held up to the lens of COVID now, isn't it? And you say, well, is this still relevant in the face of COVID? And I would say it's even more relevant now in the face of COVID. I don't know what you think about the impact of COVID on the supply chains.
Oh, I think that transparency is even more needed now. I mean, you need to understand where your products are coming from and where they are in the chain, and then ultimately their utilization. I mean, I think all of that, the tightening of the supply chain for better control and quality, has never been more important, and it's going to be more important, whether, depending on, onshoring versus offshoring, and those are all going to be critical decisions that I think are going to be more carefully evaluated in light of the pandemic. But not just automotive. I mean, I think about, many other food supply and other areas. I mean, tracking and traceability is going to be really, really pretty critical.
Yeah, and it becomes important. It seems like as things speed up and managing that supply chain is important. But if you have the connected component, it goes beyond tracking, and it includes this tracing, this what if something goes wrong, what if can I fix it over the air, where did it come from, who touched it, all of that stuff. And I feel like the world has got a set of regulations. Sometimes there are obligations around tracking and tracing and recalls and so forth, that simply can't really be achieved practically with paper and spreadsheets and that sort of thing. And that's one of the opportunities that I feel like that for the companies that really figure out how am I going to connect these components to the internet so I know where they are, one of the things that will force this to happen and overcome some of this friction is that there's actually a legal obligation to do this stuff that isn't being honored particularly well, but everyone gets away with it because it's seen as being kind of almost too difficult to do. But once a few companies show that, oh, I can wire this car seat, this alternator, and or this airbag, and I can actually know who's where the fix has been applied or where the replacement happens, suddenly the bar's raised for everyone, and people that don't have that capability, they're no longer able to sell. I mean,
just think about warranty today. It's basically you're going through a process of trying to find who owns the vehicle, and you get stuff in the mail, and it's a really haphazard, very error-prone issue with very low percentage compliance of getting the warranty issues fixed. And so I think that, you know, obviously the IoT will help fix that if you can trace the end product in terms of where that customer, who that customer is. I think consumers, you know, are going to demand more transparency on the products that they buy as to where they came from and who manufactured it and sources of the materials in the product. I mean, I think the consumer of tomorrow is going to demand that to be more apparent, more transparent to them as they purchase the product.
So how does all of this communication happen? It seems like the car has become this communications hub. And if we're going to get to the internet in the Internet of Things, you have to get there through some route. What are the options in terms of getting from the component up to the cloud? Any observations there?
Well, I think, you know, all your cars, almost all cars are turning into basically hotspots. And they all basically are hosting smartphones. I mean, whether it's through, you know, Apple CarPlay or Google Android Auto or each of the OEMs have their own access into the vehicle. So the vehicle is basically a computer with four wheels on it. So the connectivity is there. It's just a question, what objects inside the car become part of that network that can then communicate to the cloud and into the internet? It's there. The technology and the hardware is there. It's just a question of those objects inside the vehicle and what information from those objects is going to be of value to have reported as part of your dashboard, ownership dashboard. And then the other thing that will happen is, I mean, vehicles will gradually transition to be, I think, and we're in a little bit of this gray zone right now with the pandemic, but more shared mobility, more autonomous. And as that evolves, and it's not going to be quickly, but as that evolves over the next decade or so, you know, there's going to be different kinds of ownership models rather than just I own my car. There may be you have access to a fleet of cars, or you share cars, or you use micro mobility as a means to get around. I mean, so a lot of those things are going to evolve. I think the pandemic's put a little bit of a curveball in some of that, but it's definitely the trend.
Yeah. Self-driving, autonomous thing is absolutely fascinating. I have one of these electric cars, and I look at the updates, and I just am fascinated to see where the changes are going to be. What's your view on us achieving? I can't even remember what the various stages are in the kind of progression to Nirvana, where you lose the steering wheel. But what are you seeing in terms of the pace of change and achieving that nirvana? Is it realistic? Is it going to happen? When do you think it's going to happen?
I think it's definitely going to happen. You referenced electric, and I mean, I've been driving an electric car since 2012, 2013. Wow. And if you'd have told me in 2012 that we'd still have 2% penetration of electric vehicles, 3%, whatever it is, it's low. And that we're just now getting into a more ramped up portfolio of vehicles from multiple OEMs with electric drivetrain offerings, and the infrastructure is beginning to get out there, so there's more charging availability. I would have thought it would have happened 5 years ago. And I think likewise with autonomous, there's some irrational exuberance on autonomous and how fast it's going to be here. I mean, in level two stuff where you can do smart highway driving, lane keeping, smart cruise control, that's here and that's going to continue to grow. But when you get into real day-to-day driving off the highway into cities and into congested areas, it's much more problematic. I mean, we've run an experiment in Grand Rapids where Seamless is located for the last year with May Mobility, which is an autonomous micro-mobility shuttle. We've had about 60,000 rides on it. It's accumulated 50,000, 100,000 miles. I don't know what the exact number is, but it runs a 2.5 mile loop with 20 stops in the downtown city center. It's been running for about a year. It shut down due to the pandemic in March. I'm happy to announce that we just opened it up again with partnership with Planet M, which is the Michigan Economic Development Corp, the city of Grand Rapids, May Mobility, Seamless, and Seamless's partners. And then also we brought in some new clean technology because of the concern as it relates to mass transit on safety. So we're partnering also with GHSP, which is providing some smart UVC technology, and Halicil, which is doing H2O2 fogging of the interior to provide basically six log surgical room cleanliness to the vehicles at the beginning and the end of the shifts. And it's back on the road again. Running it through the city, there's all kinds of issues that, it can go from 0% autonomous to 100% autonomous. Obviously weather. Living in Michigan, there's snow, there's ice, there's accumulation of snow on the road. That is a big issue for autonomous. You can have, there's a variety of things like construction that can cause issues for autonomous. Reckless driving around the vehicle, or reckless pedestrians, bicycles around the vehicles can cause issues. Somebody parking a truck and wanting to unload furniture in the middle of the road. There's all these other behaviors that go on that make autonomous in a more congested setting challenging. And it's going to be all those edge cases that need to be solved for before autonomous can really happen at level five in a common setting. Non-controlled. So I look at that, it's probably 10 years away, before you really start thinking about autonomous taxis moving around the city freely.
Okay, that's good. I'm just doing the mental calculation of when I'm going to lose it and whether I'll be able to still enjoy going to the beach in downtown, even though I don't trust myself to drive. So I think I might just about be okay. Going back to the trial, though, can you explain a bit more how autonomous is it? How do you request one of these cars? Is there an app or something?
Basically, it's integrated into the bus system. So it's basically the city circulator system that the bus runs. We've integrated these micro-mobility vehicles into that route system. So there's a fleet of eight of them, and I think at any given time there's four of them on the road. They run 6 days a week, about 12 hours a day, and they just pick up people at the bus stops. And they do autonomous functionality. There's a tender in the vehicle with the monitoring the vehicle's functionality in there to take over if there's an issue with any number of things, whether it be weather or different obstructions that may occur on the road. But the objective is to have it run basically in 100% autonomous mode, and basically transport people around the city.
And can you say how close you are to that 100%? How often does a human being need to intervene?
Well, there's days and there's that it can be 100% autonomous. There's just that there are also periods of time where there's inclement weather, there's maybe an incident happened, unplanned construction, say a sewage main breaks. And there's incidents like that require a driver to take over. And then therefore it's non-autonomous during those periods of time.
Amazing. Well, this has been a fascinating conversation, Dana. Thanks so much for taking time out. If someone wants advice or help, either if they're on the corporate side or a CEO of a startup that wants to pick your brains, how can they get in touch with you?
You can get me at Dana@seamlessiot.com.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for spending time with us. And it's always a pleasure. And I always learn stuff. And I really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much.
So it's got to the point in the show where, Dana, I kind of ask our guests about them. Musical tastes, and the construct is, what are the three songs that you would take to Mars? And I sometimes start this by saying, is music important to you? But I think that's kind of a stupid question, given that you have four guitars, beautiful guitars, hanging up on the wall behind you. What part does music play in your life?
I love music. Is a way to relax, is something to appreciate. Seeing people that are really talented in music, you're seeing real artists. So I enjoy it. For me, it's a way to relax. It's a hobby. I've long ago quit playing seriously. I did that in college years, but now it's really just about, playing songs that I listen to and I hear, and I go, that'd be an interesting one to learn. And it's just a great hobby to relax to.
What did you do in college?
I played, college bands and parties and places like that with a group.
All right. What kind of music?
Mostly rock and roll. Back to my generation, right?
Right. Excellent. Well, okay. So if you had... This is like the toughest part of our interviews. You've got three songs you had to take on a journey. What would the three songs be for you?
I think the first song that I would bring would probably be Stairway to Heaven. And it's generationally tied right into me in terms of, that was kind of a big song when I was late high school, early college. I also used to play it in bands. It's got some great transitions and goes from soft to loud and some excellent lyrics in it. I think probably second tune might be Imagine by John Lennon. In the lyrics in that, if I was going to Mars and thinking about building a new civilization, those are some really powerful lyrics to build that civilization off of. To go way back in time, maybe pick up something like Beethoven's Fifth, just to see the genius of human creativity and the collaboration that exists within an orchestra setting. I think that would be another song that I might like to bring. I was thinking about cliche stuff, like David Bowie's Space Odyssey or Life on Mars or something, but it's too cliche. So those would probably be the three songs that give some diversity and have different rationale as to why I would pick them.
Great, great choices. So where did you grow up? Where were you when you were a kid?
I was born in Boston, Massachusetts. I went to high school in Ohio, and then I moved to Michigan. Went to school at Western Michigan University, and then I got my MBA at Oakland University in Detroit area.
All right. And was it the car industry that pulled you there? What did your dad do?
My dad worked at National Cash Register, which NCR. Oh,
yeah, yeah.
And he moved, he's in sales, so we moved a few times with that and ultimately ended up in the Detroit area. And then if you're in the Detroit area, you end up graduating college and in many cases go to the automotive industry. And I went and started my first job was at General Motors in product planning and marketing.
So you learned the automotive industry really from the inside. And how did you end up at Forcia?
Forcia ended up, we were at Johnson Controls, a group of us, and Forcia wanted to build a kind of a clean sheet of paper innovation organization. And I was recruited to be part of that organization. So we had the privilege of really helping Forcia establish a global innovation process and teams and help them innovate in the different product categories. So it was really great opportunity, great experience. Did a lot of global work for them. They're a very international company, and I got the privilege of establishing technology listening posts in a variety of markets, and then innovation clusters in several markets, three different continents. So it's a good experience, and was a fun process of building that.
Yeah, it's. I think about my own career and the companies I've worked at, and you like to think you've contributed something, and you have. If you've been with, you were at Forcia for like 14 years, so there was something that was working very well there. But I feel like it's you join a band and you get this trip with the band, and you go to places you would never have imagined on your own. It's a great privilege to be part of these brands that take you around the world and everything. Well, very good. Thanks, Dana.
Yep. Thank you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.